2 days after 9/11, 2001, when the Twin Towers fell in Manhattan due to terrorism, Tim Keller, he's a pastor in New York, his wife Kathy, she read this article, and it asked the question, well, it said, the real problem with the world is fundamentalism. I recently heard an atheist say something extremely similar to that, and this really gets us to the heart of the question that Chase took up last week. Do we really need religion? Isn't it a toxin? For many in the West, and for more and more, it seems, in the West, the answer is no. We do not need religion. We have it just poisons things. We have the good that we need. Now, things seem to be changing a little bit with regard to that, and I will address that toward the end of this sermon. But the line of thought about how we don't need religion and fundamentalism is the real problem in the world. The line of thought seems to go something like this in the West. Religion leads to wars and bigotry and slavery and oppression of women, especially, and homosexuals and transsexuals and minorities of every stripe, not to mention the fact that it is anti-science, unreasonable, and more broadly opposed to reason because it's based on faith. Rather than religion, therefore, let's have reasonableness. Now, I'm not quoting anybody. I'm just sort of trying to, not caricature, but trying to sort of broadly state what seems to be a growing majority position in the West. Rather than religion, therefore, let us have reasonableness and rationality, science and its benefits, you know, technology, modern medicine, all the rest, decency, preservation, and protection of basic human rights, and full freedom to live as we please. Let's cut the cord between religion and reason and rights and ditch religion while keeping the reason and rights and all that come along with them. I hope that doesn't sound like a caricature. I feel like, and I think that is something like what we are encountering here in the West. And what I hope to do over the next few weeks with help from Chase and Nathaniel is to make a case for why this is wrong. This is not true, and this is actually deadly, and it's deadly against things like reason and science and human rights, and including rights of minorities and the underrepresented and the weaker. So what I want to do today in particular, next week I'll be focusing on, you know, as it were, faith versus reason and science, but this week, today, this morning, I want to focus on the case of Christianity and human rights, or we could phrase it Christianity or human rights. Do you have to have one or the other? Does Christianity do away with human rights? Does it lessen human rights? Does it militate against them, or does it provide for them? So I want to make a case for why it provides for them and it doesn't militate against them, and that because it provides for them, that if you take away Christianity in a culture, eventually you're going to see human rights diminish and possibly disappear. To take just two examples, you can't have reason without God, and you can't have human rights. So, like I said, I'm going to speak to reason and science next week, but today I want to speak to human rights. The goal, though, isn't just to argue against the secular case for reason and rights severed from religion, but also to walk through purported Christian defeaters in our culture so that you guys can articulate and discuss the good news of what God has done in Jesus Christ to those who live and work in the world that you live in here in Houston's West Galleria area. We absolutely want you to bring people that have questions, skeptics, unbelievers, but believers that want to reach those that just have questions, and that's almost everybody. We want you to come with questions. We want you to send these talks to others and to take this information and have it help you as you share the hope of Jesus with the lost that God has placed around you. In 1867, the Victorian English poet Matthew Arnold published a poem called Dover Beach, describing the ebb, the waning of Christianity. It's receding in Europe. So this is 1867, and one of the stanzas reads, "The sea of faith was once too at the full, and round earth's shore lay like the folds of a bright girdle furled. But now I only hear its melancholy, long, withdrawing roar. In his podcast, The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, Justin Brierley refers to Arnold's poem as a eulogy for the certainties of a bygone era. Christianity definitely seems to be waning in the West. It seems to be on the decline in our world. Last week, Chase spoke to the rise of the nuns, especially among Gen Z and the younger generation. But as Chase also said, and as we likely perceive, spirituality, even though religion seems to be formal religion, seems to be on the decline in the younger generations, at least, spirituality is on the rise. Spirituality of all sorts. In fact, paganism has returned. Lewis Perry, who, by the way, she is no Christian as far as I know. She's an ardent feminist. And those two things aren't exclusive by any means, and I'll preach a sermon on that in the future, God willing. But she argues in a really great article, Louise Perry does, that paganism never went away in the West, it just receded, but that it is re-encroaching with a vengeance. So there's a story about an old fish that's swimming in the ocean, and he swims his way one morning past two younger fish, and he says, "Hey boys, how's the water?" And as soon as he passes, one of the younger fish looks at the other one and he says, "What the hell is water?" You know, fish don't know what water is because that's all they know. They're surrounded in it. It's what they swim in. It's as it were the air they breathe. It's their complete environment, so they don't have a critical perspective on it. And that is really, I think, a pretty good example of human rights here in the West. It's the water we swim in. It has been for centuries. And it's something we just assume. It's just something we assume that humanity has always had. If we haven't read any history, if we haven't traveled very much, we just assume, yeah, everyone values human rights. Everyone knows that they have them. You know, secular humanists in the West cling to them and tout them. And again, like I said, in large part, assume them. Assume that they're just a basic understanding of all humanity around the world and throughout history. So let me quote from a British attorney, a solicitor, and academic, Anthony Julius. He wrote in The Guardian in 2010, "A human rights discourse now dominates politics. There's a powerful human rights movement. It's the new secular religion of our time." Pastor and author that I've mentioned a second ago, Tim Keller, he said, "Most secular people today hold a set of ethical beliefs about the nature of human life. Many would describe themselves as liberal humanists who are committed to science and reason, the progress and the good of humanity, and to the rights, equality, and freedom of every individual human being. Secularity is marked by a call to take active responsibility for the progressive improvement of the world, to work for the betterment of other humans, even strangers beyond our shores. And it is argued, removing the influence of religion in the world will help us realize our values." He says that in Making Sense of God, and that's says better what I was the sort of case I was trying to lay out at the beginning here of this sermon. An increasing swath of society in the West, and at least until recently, seems to want to take the human rights that grew out of Christianity, but leave Christianity behind. Historian Samuel Moyne, he said, "Christianity is the global faith that many would like to, excuse me, Christianity is the global faith that many would like human rights to become." Human rights lawyer Francesca Klug authored a book titled Values for a Godless Age, and columnist Deborah Orr writes, "For human rights to flourish, religious rights have to come second to them." And there are a few problems with this statement and with this kind of mentality. The first is that if you sever the branches, human rights, from the root, Christianity and its source, the Bible, the branches will wither and die. And I'm going to argue that human rights actually stem from and grow out of Christianity. And because the Bible and the Judeo-Christian faith that grows out of the scriptures has been what is the text that has most shaped the West, the Christian West, the Christian until recently. Human rights have flourished. And where we don't see human rights in the West, and I'll argue this and more in coming sermons, God willing, but where we don't see human rights being championed in the West, like with slavery in the West, for example, it is simply something that actually is it's Christians not acting Christianly and not acting in line with the scriptures that their faith grows out of and is founded on. It's Christians being inconsistent with what the scriptures call for. But if you sever the branches, the human rights, from the root, which is Christianity and the source of the Bible, the branches will wither and die. And we're seeing this take place in our culture as we turn away from Christianity and Christ, as we turn away from the Bible as our authority. As a church and in the West, as a culture, we are seeing this thing that we've taken for granted. We are seeing human rights begin to misshape, begin to morph, begin to disappear in some ways. And so it's like lopping a branch off of a trunk for a little bit, for a few days. The branch looks the same. If you look at it's still got leaves on it, it's still green. The actual branch looks the same, but if you leave it there long enough, severed from its life-giving source, from its root, it's going to die. And we're starting to see that in the West. And I want to argue that it's because we've severed human. We're trying to have the human rights severed from their source. But secondly, this doesn't work because it's ironically self-defeating. How do you get rid of Christianity but keep human rights when the free exercise of religion is a human right? And it's actually one of the human rights that our founders came over and wrote a constitution to guarantee. The free practice of one's faith based on conscience. You know, the right to worship freely is a right guaranteed by the laws of our land that gave our land rise. Like I said, it's why folks came over here in the first place to this land. So it's ironically self-defeating because Christianity is a human right. So how can you have human rights and not Christianity? And it's also ironic just based on the history of our country and how we were founded. And just sort of as a corollary to that, how are we to decipher between human rights and religious rights so that we can give a backseat to the latter? Since, again, religious rights are human rights, it's impossible to separate the two, or deadly anyway. So we need to ask what I've been assuming up till now, where do human rights come from? Well, they don't come from a materialistic view of the world, from a secular humanist perspective. If we are all just, from a materialist or a naturalist human, secular humanist perspective, if we are all just stardust, why treat a person differently from a star or from dust? Dirt, snail, a dinner plate, a baby, they're all made of the same stuff. And according to the materialist worldview and philosophy, there's really no distinction. If they're all just atoms, there's no fundamental difference between them. There's no basis, therefore, if we extrapolate from treating a baby differently than a snail or than dirt or than a dinner plate. You know, you step on dirt, you don't feel bad about it unless you're strange. You break a dinner plate if you're at a Jewish, on accident, or if you're at a Jewish wedding or a Greek wedding, you might see some plates broken and it's done in celebration and you throw those plates away. And if we're all just stardust, then you can do that with a baby. You can do that with a human. And look at what we have started to do in the West as we have severed human rights from Christianity. We're doing that very thing. We'll come back to that as we look at other cultures. When you think about Darwinism, there's a Russian philosopher, which Darwinism, by the way, is founded on. It's atheistic, you know. Russian philosopher Vladimir Solovyov's sarcastic summary of the ethical extrapolation that comes from secular humanism. He said, man descended from apes, therefore we must love one another. And of course, that's nonsense. There's no basis. There's no basis for this. Survival of the fittest is the opposite of that. The strong prey on the weak. And the progeny of this thought system, of this Darwinist thought system, is rather than we must love one another, it's the progeny of atheistic materialist Marxism. The progeny of this thought system is atheistic materialistic Marxism, materialist Marxism, or Stalinism, Nazism, where tens of millions died, most by murder in the 20th century. To throw out some numbers, 61,911,000 by the Soviet state alone, 35,236,000 by the Chinese communists, and 20,946,000 by the Nazi state. Friedrich Nietzsche said that we are all the same tissue of forces. So you and the snail and a star and a salt shaker and the sand are all the same tissue of forces in the materialist conception. You can stomp on the sand, you can stomp on someone's face. It's the same thing. Except that we know, as soon as I say that, we know that it's not the same thing. There's something in us that cries out against that absurdity, but it's an absurdity that materialist logic leads us to. Nietzsche's way of saying this is judgments, value judgments concerning life for or against can in the last resort never be true. There are no oughts, right? A logical consequence of naturalism and materialism is that there are no oughts. There are no rights. You ought to be treated this way. I ought to be treated this way. There are no rights or wrongs. There's only is. There's only is. This group is in power, and therefore this other group or these other groups are going to suffer. But invoking a value judgment of truth by saying that there can be no value judgments or truths is self-contradictory. So if Nietzsche's right, this judgment that there are no value judgments must be, it must be true. But if then, if it is true that there would be truths in value judgments, and that would refute his claim that there aren't. So it's self refuting. Even Nietzsche can't say this without being inconsistent to his own worldview. It's incoherent. It doesn't hold. Literary critic Terry Eagleton writes, Nietzsche sees that Western civilization is in the process of ditching divinity. And this is, of course, Nietzsche is writing well over 100 years ago. But he saw that Western civilization was in the process of ditching divinity while still clinging to religious values. And that this egregious act of bad faith, Eagleton writes, must not go uncontested. Our conceptions of truth, virtue, identity, and autonomy, our sense of history as shapely and coherent, all have deep-seated theological roots. In short, Nietzsche shows how morality and rights are grounded in God. They exist. These rights exist if God exists. If God doesn't, then they don't. It's really as simple as that. And one of the reasons that Nietzsche is so effective is because he sees the implications of a universe without God, and he calls them out clearly. He's a lot more consistent than many who tout naturalism, atheism in whatever form, and then go ahead and also espouse human rights. He says, no, you can't have one without the other. Fyodor Dostoevsky's Ivan and the Brothers Karamazov, who's an atheist character, he says that without God, everything is permissible. And that's right. That's Nietzschean logical understanding of a world without God. Everything is permissible without God. There's an iron determinism of naturalism. There's no freedom. When you think of personal freedom, it's a cherished human right in the West. It may be America's, other than just wealth and riches, it may be our most cherished human right. The idea that, and I think it's even a perversion of freedom, but the idea that I'm a free moral agent and I I need to be able to do whatever it is that I want to do. In the strictly materialist universe, freedom is an illusion, though. There is no God. If everything is just stardust, if everything is material, everything is determined. Everything is just a concatenation of atoms. We are prisoners of our atoms. We're prisoners of energy bouncing around. Atheist Harvard professor Steven Pinker admits this when he speaks of our actions being the result of chemical reactions in the brain in his book, The Blank Slate. You can trace this all the way back to the Big Bang. Everything has been scripted from the minute that that explosion happened. Everything as matter necessitates this. There's nothing that intervening, nothing from above, nothing that created us distinct from matter, distinct from the stars. Fascinatingly, Tim Keller comments that these facts about the iron determinism of the universe in a naturalist cosmos have not yet penetrated the public consciousness at all. And you know, he's right. Why haven't they, though? Because I want to just contend that it's because we feel deeply that iron determinism isn't true. And if it is, then we can't live consistent with that understanding. We can't live like it's true. It's too hopeless. It's too cruel. But we don't want to submit to the God that we know is real, who alleviates and obviates and removes this problem of iron determinism. Thomas Nagel, another atheist, emeritus professor of philosophy at NYU, he admits this insoluble problem that is presented here in the naturalist worldview in his book Mind and Cosmos. And the subtitle is Why the Materialist Neo-Darwinian Conception of Nature is Almost Certainly False. I'm not even going to mention, and I will mention this probably more in a future sermon, but the idea that the reasoning capacities that we have, meaning itself and the ability to logically deduce and to reason, aren't provided. Even the idea that we could reason about the iron determinism that a pure materialist conception of the universe produces, even that reasoning, it's how do we reason that itself from a materialist universe? We wouldn't be able to. Our reason would hold as much water as, and should be as respected as, you know, a puddle of water on the dirty ground. I mean, there is reason and meaning are not provided for in a materialist closed universe. But that's, I just mentioned it in passing. I'll probably come back to it more forcefully in another sermon. But that's just another problem for naturalism. So another thing, you do you and I'll do me. Follow your heart. This is the private ethic that is such a part of our zeitgeist. Where does it lead? Well, Nietzsche again, I quote Nietzsche a lot because he's a smelling salt for us. He really helps us see what a godless universe leads to. Nietzsche in Thus Spoke Zarathustra, he says that man is hard to discover, hardest of all for himself. He, however, has discovered himself, who says, this is my good and evil. With that, he is reduced to silence the mole and the dwarf, who say, good for all and evil for all. In other words, there are no absolute values. There's nothing that's good for everyone or evil for everyone. You do you, I'll do me. There is only what is good for me and what is bad for me. And yours might be different. And that's really our culture right now. Values aren't grounded in something above us, applying to all of us, therefore. Rather, values are grounded within us and apply to me and to no one else, and you to yours, yours to you, excuse me, etc. So rape and murder in this system, I can call good for me. And compassion and humility, I can call evil. And indeed, that's just what Nietzsche, that's just the sort of thing Nietzsche said in his writings. He called Christianity the slave religion largely because of the humility and compassion and mercy that it promoted. And he talked about the Übermensch that was able to rise above these things and take control and take power and dominate and have his will done. And of course, his protege took hold of these things and did a lot of damage with them. And of course, I'm speaking of Adolf Hitler, who was a great devotee of Nietzsche and a practitioner. What about when my good, not yours, my own private good, murder and rape, let's say, what about when that clashes with your good, because it's you that I'm murdering and or raping? It's good for me. in this conception, but what about for you? So who then is to decide between us? And you can see that that's a society that simply has broken down. We all see our society in the larger West sort of heading down this garden path, but it's not a garden path. It's a charnel house. It's a graveyard. We are descending into this abyss once more. Some who see this are checking their secular humanism and questioning it and digging into the roots of human rights in the West. From whence did they come? And the answer is clear. They came from the Bible. They came from the Bible. We want to ask, does my worldview support the values that I cherish? I cherish these human rights. Well, does my worldview, my view of everything is matter, with no God, with no beginner, let's say, does that support, does it philosophically support human rights? Does it philosophically support the ability to reason and think at all? Does it philosophically provide for meaning? So, as I've been saying, secular humanism, atheism, naturalism does not provide for human rights, whether they be women's rights or racial equality or the rights of minority parties. Where do they come from? Where do human rights come from? Well, they come from Christianity. Jinping, I'm so slaughtering the pronunciation of his name, I'm sure of it. In 2015, at least, he was a member of the Standing Committee of the National People's Congress, China, and the director of the Institute of World Religions. The Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. He writes, "Only by accepting this Christian understanding of transcendence as our criterion can we understand the real meaning of such concepts as freedom, human rights, tolerance, equality, justice, democracy, the rule of law, universality, and environmental protection." Keller quotes this in Making Sense of God, and so does Neil Ferguson in his book Civilization, the West and the Rest. So let me put it pithily with a story that's told by Jewish thinker Dennis Prager. He says, suppose that you're driving late at night and your car breaks down. You're alone and your car breaks down in a really, really bad part of town, really dangerous. And it's late, it's completely dark. Let's say you don't have your cell phone with you. And you get out of your car and immediately you see a group of men, 10 men, let's say, come out from a side street and they start walking towards you. Well, what if you found out at that moment that they had just gotten out of a Bible study? How would you feel? So that speaks, I think, a lot just in that little parable about what the Bible, what truly clinging to the scriptures and founding your life upon them and upon the one to whom they point and who embodies them and who fulfills them, Jesus Christ. What it says about how that forms a people, how it forms a society, and even says, I think, suggests a bit about where human rights sprang from. So not only are human rights assumed, which perhaps contributes to our surprise when we find, I mean in the West, human rights are assumed to be good things, universal things in the West. I think it contributes to our surprise when we find that their roots are in the Bible and the Judeo-Christian faith that comes from it. But so is the idea, not only of human rights, but of the individual person who has these inviolable rights. The very notion of personhood comes not just from the Bible, but in particular from the New Testament, and more specifically from the Incarnation. Erich von Küchnelt-Leden writes, "It's well to recall that the concept of person as we know it did not exist in antiquity. It appeared in the Western world with the advent of Christianity. In the ancient world, the state was all that mattered, or the family, this sort of smallest conception of the state, some form of the collective, but the person, and that person with basic inborn human rights, not at all. This is why atheistic Marxism destroyed the rights of the individual and subordinated them to the demands of the collective. You remove God, and you remove the very thing that gave rise to personhood. Man becomes a blob, a mass to be molded by the will of those in power, by the larger collective." Many think that human rights emerged out of the Enlightenment, which gave credit to the Greeks and to a lesser degree to the Romans, but no. Septuagenarian Oxford professor Larry Sedentop says, "There was no notion of the rights of individuals against the claims of the city and its gods. There is no formal liberty of thought or action. Citizens belong to the city, body and soul. The Spartan king, when asked about the justice of seizing a Theban citadel in peacetime, replied, "Inquire only if it was useful. For whenever an action is useful to our country, it's right." Men, women, children, and slaves were slaughtered or enslaved without compunction, says Seedentop. It's the same today in many parts of the world and increasingly in the West as we depart from God. The gods that you worship give you and shape your worldview. The Greek gods were capricious and self-centered, and humans were their playthings. Aristotle thought that certain men were born to be slaves, others their masters. In Greco-Roman culture, a man's, quote, wife counted only as part of her husband. That's Seedentop in his book, Inventing the Individual. And make no mistake, gods are worshipped in the naturalist, secular humanist conception, whether they're gods of self or gods of nature or both. Even in the East today, moving from classical antiquity to today, Hinduism, largely in India, it does not provide for human rights, but it rests on the doctrine of karma undergirds Hinduism and gives rise to it. And the idea of karma, among other things, is that you get what's coming to you, and so your position, your station in life is because of, when this is combined with reincarnation, it's your station in life now is a result of your former life. So if you're a dude on a skateboard that's begging on the side of the road, that's dirt poor and you have no arms and no legs, you were born that way, it's because you did something in a former life in this worldview, in this philosophy, in this religious system. You did something in a former life to deserve that. And so the idea of helping that person and providing for them because they're less fortunate and in need isn't at all encouraged in Hinduism. And so there's a cruelty to the lowborn. Their station, their suffering is their fault. And of course, the flip is true for those that have, you know, those that have a lot more, that are born well with lots. They can take credit for that because they must have done something in this conception in a former life that made them deserve to be born the way they were. And so they, you know, it's cyclical. It feeds on itself. They continue to look down on those that have less and those that are unfortunate. So Vishal Mangalwadi, in his book, The Book That Made Your World, about the Bible, he tells a story of a little girl, Sheila, that was discovered to be in a home of parents with other children, and she was 18 months old, and she was so malnourished. She had flies all around her, and she was completely emaciated. She was so malnourished that her femur was the width of someone's, like an adult's, pinky finger. She was an 18-month-old living skeleton, he writes, lying on a bare string cot. And what he found out after lots of questions and time went by is that it wasn't that they didn't have money to feed her. It's just that Vishal and his wife begged them to let Vishal and his wife take this little girl Sheila to the hospital, and they did that, but then they brought her back, and this family eventually just let her die because she was making life harder for them, because they were gonna have to feed her, and then eventually if they were gonna marry her off, they were gonna have to provide a dowry for her, and so they were just gonna cost her more and inconvenience them. And so their Hindu background didn't give her a human right to life. And we're seeing this same sort of thing, a very similar thing, happen here in America as we cut away our Judeo-Christian heritage that comes from the scriptures. We're seeing abortion on the rise. We're seeing euthanasia on the rise because we've abandoned the God of the Bible and the Bible. Infanticide, just death by exposure, just leaving young kids, infants outside to die of exposure, die of the elements, die of hunger, die of being ravaged by wolves, just leave them on a hilltop. Infanticide was common in Rome. And if we continue to move away from the Bible and the gospel, it will become common here too. Now, Tim Keller, he writes that, quote, Nietzsche's critique of secular humanism has never really been answered adequately. Commenting on the writings of George Eliot, Nietzsche observes presciently that the English-speaking world, I'm quoting Keller here, he says, Nietzsche observes presciently that the English-speaking world would try to abandon belief in God, yet maintain the values of compassion, universal benevolence, and conscience. But Nietzsche predicted that in societies that reject God, morality itself will become a problem. And that's what we're seeing. Keller writes of Nietzsche's predictions, it will be harder and harder to justify or motivate morality. People will become more and more selfish, and there will be no way but coercion to control them. In his book, Beyond Good and Evil, Nietzsche mocks the philosophy of the utilitarians, those who promote human rights and compassion as simply practical wisdom, the best way to pursue the greatest good for the greatest number. And that's Peter Singer's philosophy as a utilitarian himself and a philosophy professor of ethics, of all things, at Princeton. I just bought his book, The Most Good That You Can Do. I never thought I'd buy a Singer book, but I did. He says that animals should have the same rights as humans, which is a logical extension of the materialist worldview. We're all stardust. His famous, or rather infamous, sort of stance on babies outside the womb should be able to be have their lives taken, should be able to be killed up to 3 years old. I think he ratcheted that up to 7 years old now because they just don't provide enough utility to society. I mean, a baby outside the womb for the first few years is just take. They're not operating machinery. They're not they're not plying the ground. They're not writing poetry or music. They just poop and eat and ask for things and are messy. And so based on a utilitarian philosophy and matrix, they're not contributing. And therefore, quote, I'm quoting Singer here, the life of a newborn baby is of less value than the life of a pig, a dog, or a chimpanzee. That's him and his Cambridge-published Practical Ethics. And of course, you could take that from newborn baby all the way up to a few years old in Singer's conception. But he says, don't eat meat because your pleasure from eating meat doesn't outweigh the pig or the cow's displeasure and pain at dying so that you can have meat. So both this people who don't provide society with enough utility can and should be dispensed with and killed, and don't eat meat. It sounds, those things combined sound a lot like Hitler. He was a vegetarian. He also thought that folks that didn't contribute to society and folks that were, in his conception, subhuman because of their race should be dispensed with, and he did that on a massive scale. It's no accident that there's a correlation there. It's also no accident, in my opinion, that Sam Bankman-Fried was a devotee of Singer, a utilitarian. He was as far as I understand it. I'm listening to Michael Lewis's book Going Infinite on Bankman-Fried right now, but he seemed to be an agnostic atheist. And was a utilitarian devotee of Singer, do the most good for the most people. And yet, you know, he's been sentenced recently to 25 years in prison for losing billions of dollars for lots and lots of people and causing them a lot of pain. And I don't think that's an accident. In 2012, Duke philosophy professor Alex Rosenberg delivered an honest assessment of the implications of naturalism and of materialist atheism. He said, this is in The Atheist Guide to Reality, Enjoying Life Without Illusions. This is a sort of question and answer both given by him, both question and answer. Is there a God? No. What is the nature of reality? What physics says it is? What is the purpose of the universe? There is none. What is the meaning of life? Ditto. Why am I here? Just dumb luck. Does prayer work? Of course not. Is there a soul? Is it immortal? Are you kidding? Is there free will? Not a chance. What happens when I die? Everything pretty much goes on as before, except us. What is the difference between right and wrong, good and bad? There is no moral difference between them. Why should I be moral? Because it makes you feel better than being immoral. Is abortion, euthanasia, suicide, paying taxes, foreign aid, or anything else you don't like forbidden, permissible, or sometimes obligatory? anything goes. To quote Dostoevsky's Ivan once more, if there is no God, all things are permissible. If you want to get a t-shirt made that'll turn some heads and start some conversations, get that t-shirt made. If there is no God, all things are permissible. By contrast, we have the biblical story in the early chapters of Genesis, which I should probably read. Don't even have my Bible open. And this is a Greek New Testament. So, God makes everything, and he makes it good. He exists separate from creation. He speaks and makes all things purposefully with order and beauty. And he finishes the cherry on top of his creation. He finishes with humanity, with man and woman. And humanity alone he distinguishes as in his image, in his likeness. So Genesis 1:26 says, "Then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness. And let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over all earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And, you know, this is the one thing that roots human rights, that anchors the rights of humanity. And severed from this doctrine of humans made in the image of God, our human rights will founder, they will dissipate, they will disappear. But not only in this text does God make man in his image, he makes woman in his image. He makes both man and woman in his image. And there's a godlike dignity and a basis, a firm and anchored basis for human rights for man and for woman in this ancient text. And there's nothing else like it that I know of. There's nothing else like it in the ancient world. Equal rights and equal dignity for both sexes. And yes, there are two sexes. There are two genders. That's a different sermon. It's coming down the pipeline in the next few weeks. But the other thing we can just infer from this, the text here that I just read at the end of Genesis 1, the first chapter of the Bible, is that we can infer multiple personhood in God. Let us make man in our image. And he makes man and woman, two persons, to image the one God. So one of the implications here, both in the way he speaks and the fact that he makes in his image man and woman, two persons, is that God is, he's multiple in his personality. He is multiple persons. We know now through the incarnation of the Son of the Living God, he is Father, Son, and Spirit. That provides for individuality. It provides for love between persons even before anything was created. It's the foundation of who God is. There's unity among those persons, and there's life coming from the love between those persons in the Godhead. And that is what we were created for. It's what we were created to be brought up into in the love of God, and that we were created to have for one another as man and woman, as husband and wife, and with the children that we create with the love between man and wife as we are fruitful, as we multiply, as we fill the earth with image bearers of the living God. So that's all packed in there, all that and so much more. And then also there's distinction. Thirdly, there's distinction. Here in this text, the rule of man and woman over the birds, the beasts, the fish, the plants, the oceans, the land. There is a distinction that humans alone are made in God's image. Everything is good. Everything that God made is good, but humans alone are God makes in his likeness, in his image. And all things that God makes have intrinsic value. All things are good, but man and woman are special. They alone bear the stamp of God, being like him. They bear the stamp of Imago Dei. And Imago Dei, the very image of God, it alone anchors this. There's a distinction. We are not just stardust. We're special. We're separate from, and yet called to care for and rule over and cultivate this creation as godlike creatures dependent on him as vice regents over creation. And then in the biblical account, Adam and Eve, our forebears, our parents, they turn from him. They rebel against him. They break his word. And death sets in. It sets into them. It severs them from themselves, from one another, from God. And we refer to this as the fall. The fall. And centuries pass in the biblical narrative. Centuries pass in history. But God, in time, creates and chooses a people for himself through whom he will bring blessing back to the world, the Jews, from Abraham. And he reveals who he truly is to them, and through them he promises to restore creation that has fallen and to restore them to himself into right relationship with him. And through them he will send Messiah. So he will bring blessing back to the world. He'll make it good again. He will reverse the curse through this people, through the Jews. And there are whispers of this at first, as early as Genesis 3 even, and then there are shouts of it by the time we get to the prophets of how he's going to do this. He's going to do it through a Messiah, a man that's foretold, like I said, is early back as Genesis chapter 3. God steps into the middle of the curse that he enunciates to Adam and Eve and to all who come from them. And he says, he promises that there's going to be a son who's going to come from the woman who will crush the serpent's head. But it's not going to be without having his heel crushed. And then in the fullness of time, we read in the Gospel of John and in the other three Gospels that in the fullness of time, and we read it, of course, in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, in the prophecies, in the fullness of time, that Messiah came. God, the very Son of God, he became a man. Let me just go ahead and read. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. Verse 14, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. And the final verse in John's prologue, verse 18, no one has ever seen God. The only God who is at the Father's side, he has made him known. So, in the fullness of time, God sent his own Son. He passed through the heavens. He was born of a virgin, God his Father, Mary his mother, fully God, fully man, to bring God and man back together by living a life of perfect obedience to God's precepts and dying the death of a lawbreaker. In our place, living in our place, dying in our place on a Roman cross, becoming, 2 Corinthians 5:21, becoming the sin of everyone who looks to him by faith and trusts in him, becoming their sin on the cross, bearing the wrath of God against evil and rebellion and sin that has corrupted this good creation and corrupted us, bearing that wrath as a propitiation, as a wrath bearer on the cross, and dying and bearing death and paying fully for sin, so that on the third day death could no longer hold him, because the penalty for sin is death. And so because he paid for those sins fully, death could no longer hold him. It had to release him. And that's what the resurrection means. It means that his payment for anyone who looks to him by faith is sufficient. And that payment has been made for them, and they will be saved. And so So back to, thinking about human rights and thinking about Jesus, right? Jesus had his rights voluntarily, his liberties, the one who provides for our liberties, having made us in his likeness. He stepped into this planet and stepped into our skin and into our world. And he voluntarily had his rights and his liberties stripped away from him so that we could not only retain ours, but we could regain ours as his children and as his image bearers, having the penalty paid for us by him. He brings us back with a full inheritance of a son into the Father's family, into the Father's house. Thinking back to the beginning of my talk, back to 9/11, 2001, that horrid day, and the article that Tim Keller's wife Kathy read 2 days after 9/11, the real problem with the world is fundamentalism. Well, Kathy went on to tell Tim, it depends on what your fundamental is, right? What are you fundamental about? And then she proceeded to ask him, have you ever met or heard of an Amish terrorist? And of course the answer is no. Would the world be better off without religion? Well, it depends. Again, does the religion have at its heart a man who conquered through war and killing and forced submission? Or does the religion have at its heart a man who gladly submitted to his father and died on a Roman cross to save others because of his great love for them? Not because he had to, but because of his great love for them. Because that kind of submission and love and self-sacrifice sounds like something that this world needs more of. And it also sounds like a foundation stone for and a wellspring of human rights. In our world, yes, religion is on the decline, or seems to be, but not spirituality, which is on the incline. But in the world, no. Religion, and specifically Christianity, is on the rise. The projections of those in the West of the coming decline of religion were wrong. But around the world, oh, it's Christianity is growing and has been for more in this past 100 years than ever before. In The New Christendom, The Coming of Global Christianity by Philip Jenkins, he was a UPenn professor. I mean, he wrote this 20 years ago. The average Christian, he writes, is not a mid-40s white Westerner, white male. It's something like an early 20s, a 23-year-old Rwandan woman with a clay pot on her head going down to the well to get water. There are more Anglicans in Uganda than in the entire U.S. They'd be called Episcopalians, but increasingly Anglicans here as well because of the Anglican mission to America from Africa, right, coming to re-evangelize the church in America. Tim Keller says that last Sunday, more attended church in China than in all of Christian Europe. Then there's the rest of the global South, or the majority world, as it's called, India, Central and South America, of course, Africa. And even in the West, the rise of the nuns needs a closer look. It turns out that the rise of those that don't have a religion at all is only among those who have inherited religion, inherited from parents. But as Chase pointed out, religion, it's been on the wane, but spirituality has been on the rise. And crucially, among those who choose their faith, religion is on the rise. Not who just, you know, step into it from their parents, but who choose their faith. Religion is on the rise. The tide seems to be turning. As the West darkens, lots of folks are taking a second look at Christianity, at the roots of the Western world. Prominent people and academics, some academics like Jordan Peterson, Tom Holland, Francis Collins. He directed the Human Genome Project. Tom Holland is I think a Cambridge certainly historian. I've read his book Dominion and heard him lecture about a month ago here in Houston. And of course Jordan Peterson, a Canadian academic. Anthony Flew, sort of 20 years ago. He signed a humanist, sort of secular humanist declaration in 2003, and then the next year turned around and stated that he believed he was a theist at least, and then I think he moved from that to Orthodox Christianity, but was convinced of Christianity late in life to the shock of many of his peers, and you know, very recently, like months ago, as far as I understand it, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who grew up, you know, Somali-born Islam, moved into atheism and even hardline new atheism, and has just recently come out to say that she is a Christian who believes, who stands squarely in the tradition of the Judeo-Christian scriptures, the Hebrew Bible, the Old New Testament, and I believe she professes Christ as Lord, and her husband, one of my favorite living historians, Neil Ferguson, Scotsman, but is starting this University of Austin here in Texas and is Oxford educated and has taught at Oxford, Harvard, Stanford, He's her husband, and I know that I listen to him enough and read him enough that it seems like he's moving closer and closer to the Christian faith, and certainly to recognizing the benefits of Christianity to the West. And even Richard Dawkins, you know, 3 weeks ago in his comment on Easter Day, saying I'm a cultural Christian. Of course, he's not a believing Christian. He doesn't trust in Jesus. He doesn't have a relationship with Christ. I pray that happens and that he repents of his foolishness. But he calls, you know, the beliefs of Christians foolish. Anything that's what he would dub supernatural, miraculous, he thinks is absolute foolishness. But he thinks that the cultural inheritance of the West, of Christianity, from Christianity and from the Scriptures, is really highly beneficial, and he would hate to see that go away. So because of that, he calls himself a cultural Christian. Recall Matthew Arnold's poem about the receding tide that I sort of started with. That's the thing. When you think about the tide of Christianity receding in the West, tides, when you think about tides, they recede, but only to return. Kenneth LaTourette, a Yale historian, a couple generations ago, he wrote a little gem called The Unquenchable Flame. And what he writes in that book, he charts the 2,000 years of church history, and he writes, he just shows how every time the tide of Christianity has receded, it has come back to an even higher watermark than before it receded for the past 2,000 years. And so are we even now seeing the beginnings of what will be a new high watermark of faith in Christ here in the West, a great reformation and revival? What Justin Brierley suggests may be a sea change in the West. I'm starting to feel bits of it. I want to be a part of it. I want to help it to occur in God's perfect sovereignty and providence, using the prayers and the gospel proclamation and the Christian loving and living and self-sacrifice of his people here in the West and around the world. I want to be a part of that in all those ways and more. But let me close with words, and I want you to be a part of that, you who are listening, and I want you to be a part of that by thinking about and praying over what I'm saying and researching it, considering it, sending it to friends, to skeptics, to doubters, to atheists, to agnostics, to secular humanists, to all those in between, to people from other religions, to consider the claims of Christ, and to begin reading the Bible, to begin having book clubs, discussions, to consider these things together, to probe them, to weigh them. If the present age, LaTourette says, the Yale historian, he says, of church history, he says, if the present age is one of retreat for Christianity, here in this day of seeming reverse is the preparation for the next advance. Always we need again and again to remind ourselves the secret of the church's strength is not organization. The real reason for the continuation and expansion of the influence of Jesus is in Jesus himself. I will build my church, said Christ, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. Let's pray.